Live and local, we are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set for lunch locker.
It's Rep Game with RP3, Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it. Yeah, we have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world. On Rep Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Brady under center. Victory formation. Takes the snap. Falls to an E, and that'll do it. The New England Patriots have won. The Patriots, their second Super Bowl championship in the last 3 years. And they have tied an NFL record, tied the Pittsburgh Steelers with six Super Bowl championships.
That's terrible. That's terrible. That's terrible.
Good morning, Acadiana. Welcome to a Monday edition of Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsha III, right here on 103.7 Game. And we are broadcasting live from inside the 237 Roof Studios. Give us a call today on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Apparently, there was some sort of football game that was played yesterday. There was a football game that was played yesterday. No one told the New England Patriots and Los Angeles Rams.
That's terrible. That's terrible.
We could just do that for the next 2 hours.
That was, first of all, congrats to the New England Patriots for winning, for Tom Brady getting his sixth Super Bowl title. That's the most by any player of all time. He was previously tied with the great Hall of Famer Charles Haley, defensive end for the San Francisco 49ers and Dallas Cowboys. So he stands alone now, six most Super Bowl championships by an individual player all time. Bill Belichick stands alone now, six as well, Super Bowl championships. As a head coach, he has two more as a coordinator, defensive coordinator under Bill Parcells for those great Giants teams of the late 80s, mid to late 80s and early 90s. So, tremendous accomplishment for them. But that game was just...
That's terrible.
Awful. It was, and someone, I saw someone tweet out, well, why is everyone complaining, you know, defense has really stepped up. I agree. I love defensive-minded football. I get excited when I watch on Saturday a 9-6 game. Old school, smash mouth, control the clock, run the ball, eye formation, play hard-hitting defense, guys' mouth guards get spit out with blood on them. I'm all about that. There was some of that in this game. The Patriots came in with a tremendous game plan. By the way, remember last year when Matt Patricia, he was the defensive guru. He was the defensive coordinator for the New England Patriots. That's why the Detroit Lions hired him, because he's so smart on what he does defensively. Plug in another guy back there with a headset. It does not matter. It's Bill Belichick. I think we figured that out again, didn't we? We went ahead and figured that out, that a defensive assistant under Bill Belichick, it doesn't really matter. It's Bill. And whoever's underneath him can get a head coaching job, which is happening once again today. Sean McVay, we've been told over and over again that this guy is an offensive genius. Teams are tripping over themselves this offseason to find themselves the next Sean McVay. The Arizona Cardinals hired a guy that was, as Charles Barkley would say,
that's terrible.
There you go. At Texas Tech. And Cliff Kingsbury. A guy who got fired as a college coach. But he's young, handsome, and knows offense. Oh, and he has dinner from time to time with Sean McVay. Let's give him a head coaching job in the NFL. Sean McVay is the in-vogue coach. Everyone wants to be part of the Sean McVay coaching tree. He's an offensive genius. Give it up to the hoodie. I just imagine Belichick sitting back in his darkened cave of an office and just tapping his fingers together with a wry smile on his face going, oh, offensive genius, you say.
Excellent, excellent.
Offensive genius, you say. Young and handsome, I don't care. I am old and crotchety, and I'm going to shut down your offense, and I'm going to make you look like you should be coaching. I'm going to make you look like Hugh Jackson. That's what he did. Sean McVay looked awful. Awful play calling, awful scheme. Bill Belichick outcoached his butt from the 1 yard line to the other 1 yard line all game long. All game long.
Well, I think technically you mean from the 20-yard line to the 20-yard line, and only one snap inside either 20.
Yes. Sean McVay did not have a good game as a head coach. Jared Goff was awful. Todd Gurley was, once again, not a factor. And we will talk more about that this week, how a guy that is a franchise player, a guy that's led the league in rushing, one of the top three running backs in the NFL, was a no-show in the NFC Championship game and was not a factor whatsoever in the Super Bowl. The offense was terrible. Lowest scoring Super Bowl ever.
That's terrible.
It was the first time teams had reached the fourth quarter without scoring a touchdown. I'll say it again. The first time the two teams involved in the Super Bowl had reached the fourth quarter without scoring a touchdown.
That's terrible.
I never thought I'd see the day where a Super Bowl would score less points than Miami's 14-7 victory over Washington, where the Redskins only scored their touchdown because of a dummy trying to make a forward pass on a kick. That was 1973. These two teams took football, professional football, back to 1973. Lowest scoring Super Bowl of all time. It was 3-3 at the half. It was tough to watch. The Rams were the first team in Super Bowl history. This was the 53rd game, by the way. 53rd. First team in Super Bowl history to punt on each of their first seven possessions. There were more members in Maroon 5 than they were points by the Rams. Think about it like that. More members of the halftime show performer than there were points by what we called, what everyone was deeming, this is a great team. This is the greatest show on turf, a new variation of that. You know, those great Rams teams that went to back-to-back Super Bowls, beating the Titans in dramatic fashion, then the next year losing to the Patriots in dramatic fashion. Okay, the Mike Martz offensive genius under Dick Vermeil before he took over as head coach, Martz did. First seven possessions. First seven possessions resulted in a punt. I have a question. All the teams that were hiring the new Sean McVay, how you feeling this morning? Because I like this, and not because I wanted to see the Rams lose. I actually picked the Rams to win. I like this because old school defensive minded football. It's been rammed down our throats as a football devouring public. The days of defensive football do not matter. They are over. It does not matter. Offensive football is taking over. 50-point games are taking over. This is the future. This is how it's going to be. It's going to be fun and gun, high tempo, this and this and this and this. And Bill Belichick said, you know what, bruh? No. I got an aging quarterback who did not look good either, by the way. we'll get to that. I have an aging quarterback, and I'm facing a staunch defense. I am going to shut down this offensive-minded team because that's what the Rams are. Their best defensive players, with the exception of Aaron Donald, have been two guys that they brought in free agency this year, and that was Akeem Talib and Ndamukong Suh. And you can hate Bill Belichick all you want, and you can say that their dynasty has been tainted by Spygate and Deflategate and whatever, and you may not like him because he does not deal with reporters' questions during press conferences. He doesn't give a damn. You know why? Because Bill Belichick is all about the end goal, and the end goal is winning championships. That's all he cares about. And that man has figured out every Super Bowl is different in a certain way. Every Super Bowl win that they have is different. And they have figured out a way to do that. And he is the best of all time at adjusting to what his opponents do and making adjustments. Okay, I have two great pass-catching tight ends. I'll use that as the focal point of my offense. I got Randy Moss. I can do downfield threat. Oh, if not, we can just run the ball and do screen passes. He figures out a way. And defensively, oh, everyone says my defense is garbage. I don't have enough good guys on defense. Well, I'll figure out a way. I'll figure out a way to get pressure. I'll figure a way to take out this and shut down this passing game, this passing attack. And they did it in such a fashion. It was just so impressive defensively. And the reason why I picked the Rams to win the Super Bowl on Friday's show, when we gave our picks and I said 27-24, was because of what I thought the Rams' defense would do to the Patriots, and they did exactly what I thought they would do. Give it up to Wade Phillips. He knows how to coach against Bill Belichick, and he knows how to coach against Josh McDaniel, and he knows how to slow down and stop and make Tom Brady look mortal. He did it last night. You can't knock the Rams' defense, because it wasn't the Rams' defense that lost that game last night. Tom Brady threw that interception on the very first possession. His first possession, he's 21-35, which is not great numbers for him. 262, zero touchdowns. Tom Brady had zero touchdowns in the Super Bowl. If we would have said on Friday that the Los Angeles Rams would have held Tom Brady to well under 300 yards passing and no touchdowns and forced a turnover and interception and prevented a running back from getting over 100 yards rushing, so New England would not have a 100-yard rusher, Tom Brady would be well under 300 yards passing, no touchdowns and an interception, and we would hold the Patriots to a total of 13 points. Cody, if we would have said that on Friday, what would you have said?
I mean, I would wonder how ugly the game got the Rams would win.
You would say the Rams win.
But how ugly did they win? Not just did they win, but that game got out of hand, I would almost think.
You would have thought that. Now, Julian Edelman had a great game, 10 catches for 141 yards. He helped move the chains and helped eat up clock. Gronk had 6 catches for 87 yards. But you hold Tom Brady. You held Tom Brady. Once again, Cody, Tom Brady, 260 yards passing, no touchdowns, and they did not have a 100-yard rusher. And you only gave up 13 points. Wade Phillips did his damn job. He did his job. Littleton got the interception on the first drive of the game. They put pressure. They only sacked Brady once, but they did a very good job of pressuring him throughout. Michael Brockers from LSU, he had 5 tackles. Akeem Talib did a good job. Dante Fowler. The Rams defense did a great job. They did their job. But it was the Rams' offense that was putrid. Jared Goff was 19 of 38, 229, no touchdowns and interception. He looked, I'll put it to you this way, Bill Belichick made Jared Goff and the Rams look like they were coached by Jeff Fisher. That's exactly what Bill Belichick did last night in Super Bowl 53 from Atlanta. He made Jared Goff and that offense look like they were still coached by Jeff Fisher. By the way, Todd Gurley, 10 carries for 35 yards. He was an MVP candidate at one time this year. In the NFC Championship game, Cody, and the Super Bowl, Todd Gurley had 45 yards rushing in the two games. By the way, former New Orleans Saint, Brandon Cooks, he went off. 8 catches for 120. But was this one of the worst Super Bowls you've ever seen? If you're a New England Patriots fan, look, a win's a win. Ugly is ugly. It don't matter. You still got the blue ribbon. You know what I'm saying? You still got the Lombardi trophy. 13-3, one of the ugliest Super Bowls I've seen in a long time. But congrats go out to the New England Patriots for winning their sixth title under the Belichick-Brady era. We'll be talking more of the big game from Sunday, plus much more. We got a heck of a show coming up for you today. We got Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast. He's going to join us at 9:32, talk Saints offseason and the boycott bowl that took place down in the Big Easy. And we'll have our good friend Jarrett Rozier join us at 10:32 to talk LSU men's basketball. Inexplicable loss to Arkansas. And National Signing Day coming up on Wednesday, plus much, much more. Right here, Rap Game with RP3, coming up more after this break on 103.7 The Game.
Goff is in the gun, 27 of the Patriots, second down and 10. Belt high, snap and a line drive pass down the near side. And intercepted, a leaping two-handed interception at the 5. Stephon Gilmore, the all-pro quarterback, has just intercepted the Rams quarterback, Jared Goff. And it couldn't have come at a better time for the Patriots. 4:17 to go in the game.
That's terrible.
Chuck is right. It's terrible.
That's terrible.
It's terrible.
That's terrible.
The legend Charles Barkley helping us
That's
out.
That's terrible.
On a Monday edition of Rap Game with RP3. Right here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. We're live from the 237 Roof Studios. You can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline if you want to talk about that train wreck of a professional football game that took place yesterday. Number's 337-706-0111. But let me tell you something. As bad as the game might have been, Twitter was just terrific yesterday during that game. Cody, I don't know if you saw some of these, so it's a little sharing time between you and I, my friend. I'll give credit to Sports Nation because they tweeted this out. Do you know who now has more Super Bowl appearances than the Cleveland Browns, the Detroit Lions, the Houston Texans, and the Jacksonville Jaguars?
Jared Goff?
We talked about it on Friday's show as prop bets.
Oh, who has more Super Bowl? I mean, Adam Levine?
SpongeBob.
SpongeBob. See? Dude, I popped. No lie. I don't know how it worked out, how it played out, if the little SpongeBob clip they played was supposed to be just a transition from Maroon 5 to Big Boy, or if that was Big Boy's doing, and that's what I like to believe, that's the theory I subscribe to.
That's your theory?
Is that Big Boy was like sitting on the back of his caddy at rehearsals with his big coat on and was like, hey, no, if I'm going to do this, we're going to play that SpongeBob clip before... come on. Like, that's the theory I subscribe to.
That's how you imagine that?
It wasn't the NFL or Pepsi halftime show people that were like, okay, here's where we'll put the SpongeBob clip. No, it was Big Boy demanding that we have SpongeBob lead him into his section of the halftime show. So I don't know if that's the case, but that's my theory.
With the Patriots winning, a total of 3 LSU players are going to get some hardware now, Cody. So big up to them.
Good for them.
Danny Etling, who's practice squad quarterback.
It's amazing.
Danny Etling got a Super Bowl
ring. Super Bowl ring, baby.
Super Bowl champion. Jeremy Hill, who was on IR, who was a very good...
Yes, not his fault.
Not his fault. Very good player, but he still gets the hardware. He can still say that he's a Super Bowl champion. And Frank Heron.
I remember him.
Yeah, defensive lineman. So LSU's got...
See that, Shopshire? Look at that. Defensive lineman for the Tigers on both teams in the Super Bowl. Just saying.
Oh, there it is. There it is. But as bad as the game was, and people went to, obviously, the social media and went to town, the best of the best, though, was NFL memes. And NFL memes had themselves quite a day.
At NFL memes?
At NFL memes had themselves quite a day. They tweeted out a photo. And the line above it says, "When Sean McVay doesn't eat a Snickers." And it's a picture of Jeff Fisher.
Ha! Zing.
Let's see. What are the other ones? Another one that they tweeted out during the game, last night's game. These teams are playing like they know whoever wins has to go to the White House.
Oh!
Another one I liked. Adam Levine has been on the field longer than the Rams.
Shirtless.
And then they did Maroon 5, Patriots 3, Rams 0. So, yeah, it was...
I like the last one, Maroon 5, Patriots 3, Rams 0.
I could not figure out if this was a real, if this was a fake Adam Schefter account or a real one, but it went out, this tweet, I think it's fake. It says, "Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez not expected to play tonight, I'm told."
Ouch.
I was like,
good Lord.
Twitter was on fire yesterday, dude. They were just
so the keyboard courage was a flowing last night, is what you're saying.
It was brutal. It was, and this is what happens when you don't have a game that really engulfs you into the action. I mean, when you have one team punt seven times to start the game.
What also helps that you've got one
Twitter
team,
fingers are going to get antsy.
You've got one team that's all the way on the East Coast of the country that has built up this hatred, so to speak, from other fan bases. And then you've got one team that's all the way on the other side of the country on the coast that even there no one cares about. So,
true fact, the rating for the championship games, the championship game between the Kansas City Chiefs and the New England Patriots, both games went to overtime, right? Both exciting games.
Right.
That game got a higher rating in Los Angeles than the Rams-Saints game did. That's all you got to know right there. That the in Los Angeles, home of the Rams, the people there preferred watching the Chiefs-Patriots game over their own team's game. When we come back, we're going to talk about the boycott ball. There's a hell of a party that took place in New Orleans yesterday. We're going to talk to our good friend Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast about that, as well as Saints offseason, which begins right now. Here on Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. Hope. That, of course, was the Saints boycott bowl extravaganza. There it is. The folks down in New Orleans, Saints fans, had a hell of a good time yesterday during the boycott bowl, taking their anger and turning it into a humongous second line through downtown for the boycott bowl festivities down there in New Orleans. You're listening to Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parse III, here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. We're going to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and see if that person that was yelling like that was, in fact, our good friend from the Saints Happy Hour podcast, Andrew Juge. Andrew, how are you this morning? Let's start off with, do you have a hangover, brother, from yesterday's party?
No hangover, but, it was great to see. You know, obviously, I think there's been some hearing in the national media that, the Saints fans need to get over this. And there seemed to be a little bit of public outrage and people that just don't really understand, I guess, what was going on. But, you know, I kind of viewed it. I mean, sure, you know, there was still kind of the implication of the Saints having the no call and Saints fans being unhappy with the officiating and boycotting the Super Bowl. But, you know, I think you just have to understand New Orleans and you have to understand the culture and really it's any excuse to party Certainly, they made the most of it. And so, you know, I think it was maybe a slight jab at the NFL, but I also thought it was just typical New Orleans, just ready to have a party, ready to have a good time, and really just celebrate life, celebrate the Saints. And so I thought it was pretty special, and, you know, maybe some people just don't get it.
Andrew, what did you do yesterday? Did you take part in the festivities? Did you have a little boycott party with some friends and family? What would you do yourself?
Well, personally, leading up to it, I'll be honest in that I really saw, especially waking up yesterday morning, just that felt like the Saints should have been there. And it kind of dawned on me that, you know, I had plans to go to the Super Bowl if the Saints had made it. And so, you know, you wake up and you just have these feelings of, man, I should really be in Atlanta right now. And so I spent the whole day kind of avoiding social media, avoiding TV, and really just not wanting to get into the hype of the pregame. And so, you know, I just kind of did quiet stuff with my kids and just stayed away from the noise. You know, I was kind of half planning to not watch the game or watch part of it, but my 8-year-old son really wanted to watch the game, and he turned it on, and so I kind of got sucked into seeing how it all played out. So I ended up watching the game and obviously seeing everything that happened, but it was kind of a quiet day for me, not so much celebration.
Please tell me, Andrew, that game, that what they called a game, that was not your son's first experience watching the Super Bowl.
No, it wasn't. He's kind of got a Rolodex memory of sports already, so he remembers the last few. But you know, it was an interesting game to watch. I mean, certainly from a quality perspective, it was poor. But you know, I won't say vindicated is the word because you know I think all Saints fans feel like they will take what transpired this season at the end with them forever. You know, I think on some level you never fully get over something like that. That's a game that leaves scars, especially ending the way that it did. But, you know, I think there was some silver lining there in that I really was kind of hoping that in this game it would be clear that the Saints would have made it a better game, and it would be clear that the Rams maybe weren't deserving of being in that game. And, you know, again, I don't know that I feel like the word vindicated is too strong maybe. But, you know, and I don't know that I necessarily blame the Rams for that call. But ultimately I felt like there is this kind of narrative that maybe the Saints would have made this a better game. Could they have beaten the Patriots if they had played in this game? And I think there are rumblings of that. So, you know, I think in the end, obviously I don't love the outcome. I would have liked to have seen the Saints in the game. I would have liked to have seen them win it. But you know, given what it was, I felt like that was a scenario that played out pretty favorably for New Orleans.
We're on with Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast. Andrew, I want to talk a little bit about the game. I love defensive football. That's what part of the game was last night, but it was also just poorly executed offense on both sides. Now, I want to give a ton of credit to Wade Phillips. Bill Belichick praised him immensely during the week, and you know, for good reason. He knew what Wade was going to dial up. It's the same defense he's run since 1976. It has not changed. Okay, it's have corners that can be physical and play man-to-man, and have a front seven that rushes the passer. That's what they do. And I'll give the Rams credit. They made Tom Brady look pedestrian. No touchdowns. If I were to tell you on Friday, or even before the kickoff yesterday, Andrew, if I called you up and said, Andrew, the Patriots are going to be held to 13 points. Tom Brady's going to have well under 300 yards passing. He's not going to have a single touchdown pass. He's going to throw an interception, and the New England Patriots will not have a 100-yard rusher. You would tell me what?
I would tell you they better hold the Rams to 3 points. No, I mean, obviously, if you had told me that, I would have said the Rams are going to win the Super Bowl. And so, you know, I knew that the Rams were struggling. I mean, something's been wrong with Todd Gurley. Clearly, there's something going on with his knee. And I just think his performance, as he's kind of turned pedestrian, if we can say that. And really, it kind of started, I felt like, when they lost to the Saints and really earlier in the regular season. And since then, I just feel like you look at their performance in Chicago, and they were exposed in a major way. And really, I didn't think the Rams played very well in New Orleans when they won that game, you know. And obviously, they had the official, they had the no call. But, you know, other than making a handful of passing plays down the field, I just thought offensively it was pretty clear that Jared Goff was just not making it happen. And I felt like Goff's level of play, as Gurley went away, as Cooper Kupp got injured, you know, those two factors, I feel like Goff's performance dipped significantly the last 2 months of the season. And so I'll be honest, I wasn't expecting him to play very well in this game. You know, I thought the moment would be too big for him, and I thought that Belichick would have a great plan in place.
But you did not anticipate them only scoring 3 points.
No, I didn't. No, I think offensively, obviously the Patriots played their best defensive game of the year. You could argue the Rams played their best defensive game of the year.
I would agree with both of those things, and that's the thing. As great as the Rams were defensively, and they did their job, and they forced a turnover, and they shut out Tom Brady out of the end zone, and they did their job, right? I mean, if you're a defensive
Absolutely.
Player for the Rams, you're like, we did our job. And if you're an offensive player, they looked – Bill Belichick found a way, and I said this earlier to open the show, Andrew, Bill Belichick made Jared Goff look like he was still coached by Jeff Fisher. And that's how bad he looked. I mean, that's how bad the offense looked. And Sean McVay is this young offensive dynamic coach. And look, he's a young guy. And Bill Belichick pulled out – Bill Belichick showed that he was an older coach that had been here before. Okay, he out-coached McVay in nearly every facet of the game, game plan, defensive preparation, everything, okay? And the hoodie did what he typically does, right? And this is what he does. He finds a way, and they took out Todd Gurley, who was not a factor, and they put all the pressure on Goff. And Brandon Cooks had a good game, but he was the only one. Like, and Goff struggled, and it was just another example of the Rams played their best game of the year on defense, but the Patriots were still better. Like, that's got to be, like, for them, we talked a lot about how it's going to be tough for the Saints to put how the season ended for them behind them. But for the Rams, I mean, that's my biggest thought right now. You were all in this year. You brought in Sue. You brought in Tlaib on the free agent deals this year, right? You have everyone still in their contract, Goff and everyone like that. You traded for Brandon Cooks. You got him in. It's an all-in year for the Rams. To give your best effort as a defense and then to have your offense play as poorly as you did, and you still – that game wasn't even as close as the 13-3 score indicated. How do you get off the mat if you're the Rams? And that's what I'm interested. I'm interested to see if they're going to have a big Super Bowl hangover, because if you're Sue and you're Tlaib and you're all those guys on defense, you did everything that you were supposed to do and you gave it your best and you put together a historic performance against the New England Patriots and you still lost by 10 points. Like, how do you recover from that?
Yeah, it's tough to recover, and I think there is a chance that they'll have a hangover. You know, first of all, I want to point out, you know, I think when you look at the way that game was officiated, I saw so many plays, Raymond, that earlier in the season were flagged. And I'm talking about where Brandon Cooks was arm guarded and his arm was pulled down on that almost touchdown pass. I'm talking about the numerous times where Rams cornerbacks were grabbing Patriots receivers' jerseys and it being not called. The number of hits that Jared Goff took, half of those are penalties earlier in the season. When you talk about the big controversy with quarterbacks being thrown down with force,
right,
defenders putting their body weight on quarterbacks, those were being flagged all season long. And I think that played into why we saw a low-scoring game to some degree, because when you get a 15-yard flag and 2nd and 16 or 3rd and 8 become automatic first downs because of those penalties and the drive keeps going, teams just are more reluctant to hit you. They're not pass rushing as hard, and the offense starts to move the football. So,
do you think, Andrew? Do you think the reaction? Do you think that was a conscious effort based on how both the championship games had controversial flags or lack of flags? Do you think the mindset going into the game was, we're just going to let them play? We're going to try not to throw as many penalty flags as possible here, and we're not going to insert. It seemed like to me that the refs were like, we're not going to insert ourselves into the game.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it was probably it came from the top down. I bet, you know, and it's one of those things where, as a product, the NFL's like, listen, we just had two pretty controversial games. I mean, the Chiefs and Patriots was controversial in terms of officiating. Obviously, that was kind of lost in the limelight of the Saints-Rams game and how ridiculous that was. But I'm sure that there was a directive here, like, listen, let's not get into a situation where this is Marvin controversy and fans are questioning how the game was officiated again. So let's remove the refs from the game as much as we can and let the play be dictated by the players. And so I did feel like it was a very physical game, and it was two teams where, you know, the effort level was very high and they were just letting them play. So, you know, as far as your question about the Rams bouncing back, I think it's one of those things where you mentioned they went all in. Now the Rams have been very fortunate the last 2 years. They haven't had any injuries on the offensive line, and that's pretty rare. You know, they're one of the few teams in the league that have had the same five offensive linemen start every game. I remember that happening for the Falcons the year they made the Super Bowl. All five offensive linemen were the same all year, and they were healthy. And, you know, fast forward a couple of years, and you look at the Falcons' injury luck this year and how it decimated the team. And so I just think it's hard to sustain kind of that injury luck when you put on top of that so many guys that were on one-year deals. What's going to happen with Fowler? What's going to happen with the Dominican Fu? What's going to happen with Aqib Talib? So you talk about those guys that are on short-term deals, and now Brandon Cooks' big contract is going into its second year. And so, you know, they're going to start to feel the implications of the salary cap. They're going to start to feel the implications of trading away so many draft picks and having lean drafts as they trade those picks for veteran players. And I think they're going to start to see more injuries as time goes on with some of these older players. Andrew Whitworth, their left tackle, may not even be back next year. So, you know, I think they still have a young nucleus. They still have some good young players. And I absolutely think the Rams will be good next year. But you have to cash when you take risks like that in the offseason, like trading a bunch of your draft picks, and you kind of going all in with one-year deals, you have to cash that ticket because you don't know when you'll be back. And certainly in 2009, we felt like the Saints would have another shot at this, and it took them 10 years to get back to the NFC Championship game. So nothing is promised, and it's going to be an interesting offseason to see how the Rams rebound.
We're on with Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast. Andrew, let's talk a little bit about free agency. We have the draft coming up, obviously, in a few months, but first off will be free agency. Where we stand right now, offseason officially begins. Let's talk about the Saints. We've touched on this before. You know, that they don't have many draft picks, but they could use a second rounder on maybe offensive line help or possibly a pass-catching tight end. But give me your top three needs for heading into free agency and go from three to one, the positions. What are the three need positions or areas that they need to address moving forward in free agency this year?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Watching the Patriots last night, it dawned on me how similar Brady and Breeze are at this stage of their career. And you know, Brady struggled in that game. And, you know, the times that he was kind of forced to throw to outside receivers, you know, having the arm strength to get the ball out there and having zip on his passes. I mean, those are things that we've maybe seen Breeze struggle with a little bit. So as Breeze has gotten older, I think it's harder for him to really throw the ball deep and push the ball down the field. And I think his passing game has become a lot more about efficiency and being over the middle and moving Michael Thomas to the slot or you know, wide receiver screens to Thomas. I mean, they use a lot of creative ways to get him the ball. And you look at how Brady was pushing the ball to Edelman and Gronkowski. And I really felt like that was the only thing going for Brady in that game, in the passing game. And so it made me realize, you know, as you look at Breeze and certainly having Kamara and what they do with Michael Thomas manipulating him, they're going to be able to get the ball to those two guys. The one element really missing, which I thought was critical to Brady having, especially on that touchdown drive where he hits Gronkowski on two critical plays, is having a tight end over the middle. And you mentioned tight end. To me, that is the number one need for this team. First of all, you have Benjamin Watson retiring, so he's going to be gone. You know, Josh Hill will be back. He's a backup, but the Saints need a target over the middle that has the body, has the size to move the chains and give Breeze easy throws over the middle, these short 4 or 5, 6 yard button hooks, these easy throws over the middle that allow Drew Breeze to move the chains. So I think that's going to be critical and by far the most important thing. Secondly, I think, you know, retaining some of their players. I mean, Tyler Davidson was a big reason why they were the best in the league at stopping the run. I think retaining him is going to be important. Obviously, keeping Mark Ingram. I'm very interested to see what happens with Teddy Bridgewater. So in terms of retaining players, if they lose Mark Ingram, obviously running back is going to be coming in enormous need. And then lastly, you know, one area that I would like to see the Saints improve is just having a more explosive playmaker. Ted Ginn is not as young, you know, and he certainly has still made some plays this year, but particularly in the kick return game, it would be great to see a returner. You look at how good the Saints special teams has been kicking, punting, and coverage. The one area on special teams where we haven't really seen them do as much as have an explosive return game. And so I think being able to add a guy that maybe helps them as a deep threat, as a receiver, but also is able to return kicks as a role that the Saints need to fill.
Andrew, appreciate it as always, brother. We'll be in touch with you soon. Enjoy a little bit of the offseason, get some relaxation, and if you need to, man, I'm sure you can find some videos online of some better Super Bowls to show to your son. So that way this one doesn't stay in his memory for that long.
Well, his favorite DVD is actually the Saints Super Bowl DVD. So he knows the whole game front to back. And so
there we go.
He watches that whenever he gets a chance. So we'll make sure we keep watching that one.
Appreciate you, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast joining us, breaking down some Saints boycott bowl and what they're going to be doing heading into free agency. We'll wrap up the first hour of Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. Welcome back to Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers, and we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios. The NFL, the night before Sunday's big game, they handed out their annual honors, MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, Offensive Player of the Year, and not a lot of surprises. Defensive Player of the Year went for the second straight year to Aaron Donald of the Los Angeles Rams. Defensive Rookie of the Year went to Darius Leonard of the Colts. Offensive Rookie of the Year went to Saquon Barkley of the New York Giants. The Offensive Player of the Year and MVP, as we expected, was Patrick Mahomes. And the Walter Payton Award went to Chris Long of the Eagles. And the Comeback Player of the Year went to Andrew Luck of the Colts. But Breeze did get himself an award. He was awarded the Art Rooney Sportsmanship Award. And he also finished as runner-up in the MVP voting. Breeze is believed to be the first person to finish second in MVP voting 4 times without ever winning one. That's believed to be an NFL record. Don't know what to think about that. More Rap Game with RP3 here on 103.7 The Game coming up after this.
Live and local, we are Acadiana's sports station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set for like locker.
It's Rap Game with RP3, Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it. Yeah, we have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rep Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game and 103.7thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Welcome to the second hour of Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parse III, here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios. Give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Coming up this hour at 10:32, we will welcome on our friend from Tiger Details, Jarrett Rozier. He's going to recap the LSU men's basketball head-scratching loss against Arkansas at home in the PMAC in front of a sellout crowd on Saturday. And also talk about National Signing Day coming up on Wednesday and what kind of pushes that the LSU football team is making here in the last few hours and last few days to lock up some more top recruits to come to Tiger Stadium. We'll dive all into that later. But I want to talk more Super Bowl weekend, but not the Super Bowl. We spent enough time on that game. Trust me. I think we spent probably more time than that game deserved.
That's terrible.
There we go. Thank you, Chuck. Hall of Fame is announced. The Pro Football Hall of Fame class is always announced. It's in conjunction now with the Super Bowl weekend. So it's done Saturday, the day before. And they go through the whole thing where you get the group of the finalists and they all stay in a hotel room and they all have to stay in there. And then someone comes and knocks on your door. And if you get a knock on your door, what up, Three's Company reference? If you get a knock on your door, then you're going to the hall. You're going to get your bus done in Canton, Ohio, and you're going to wear the gold jacket and take the stage. It was a hell of a weekend for folks from the boot. Former LSU offensive lineman and Leesville High star, Kevin Mawai. That's right, he was a wampus cat. I just found a way. Thank you, Kevin Mawai, getting the Hall of Fame so I could talk and bring up wampus cat on the radio. Former LSU offensive lineman Kevin Mawai and safety Johnny Robinson were elected into the Pro Football Hall of Fame on Saturday, and they were joined with former Destrehan High School star Ed Reed, and they will be part of the Hall's Louisiana-flavored class of 2019. Joining them, obviously, were first ballot selections Tony Gonzalez, one of the best tight ends to ever play the game for the longtime Kansas City Chiefs and Atlanta Falcons. Champ Bailey, first time on the ballot, long time, everyone knows him first time as a Denver Bronco. I remember him for the Redskins. That was a smart move, getting rid of him. That panned out really well for Daniel Snyder. Sorry, we won't go into my rant against the owner of my childhood team. We don't have – is there a seven-hour block we can dedicate to that on there?
It'll be look out for that new podcast, a web-exclusive content.
Named I Hate Daniel Snyder with RP3.
Yeah, that'll be a seven-hour.
You ruined my franchise. You notice how angry I'm just getting? We're just barely talking about it.
It'll be a one-episode miniseries, 7 hours of Ray just pissed.
He treats my team like it's a defunct ride at one of his stupid amusement parks.
Is that where his money comes from, amusement parks?
Six Flags.
Ah, didn't know
that's
that.
That's where he made his money.
I didn't know that.
Enough
today,
of that.
Today I learned.
And today you also saw a glimpse of the anger of Raymond.
Now I know what buttons to push. See, I remember all
I
of this.
Just want to liquor up John Riggins and have him go punch Daniel Snyder. That's my goal in life. That's on my book. Some people are like, I want to go see the Himalayas, or I want to go to, you know, run a marathon.
I want to bring world peace. No, not Raymond. No.
Your boys on his list is have John Riggins get him liquored up and go have him beat the holy hell out of Daniel Snyder. That's one of my life goals.
So if you get three wishes from the genie, like, you're blowing one on having Daniel Snyder get the hell beat out of him.
Yes, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, totally.
I may dedicate two of those.
I've been beat up a second time. I would like to redo my first wish again a second time.
Just give it to me again.
You know what? I could see myself doing that, but Roger Goodell.
Oh, there it is.
So, there you go.
So, other first ballot selections, Tony Gonzalez, Champ Bailey, Ty Law, which good for Ty Law, because he was one of the best, very much one of the best of the modern cornerbacks, modern defensive backs, how that position has evolved. Ty Law is very much was at the forefront of that, so good to see him get in. Also, contributor inductees were Pat Bowlen, longtime owner of the Denver Broncos, and Gil Brandt, former front office gentleman for the Dallas Cowboys, and now he's been working for the NFL Network for many years. Make up the rest of the eight-man class, which was picked by the 48-man selection committee at its annual meeting over Super Bowl weekend. Mawai and Robinson, the former two LSU Tigers, joined fullback Jim Taylor, class of 1976, quarterback Y.A. Tittle, class of 1971, and halfback Steve Van Buren, 1965, as former Tigers with gold jackets. Did you just hear that, Cody? Did you just... So,
I only recognize a couple of those names, and one not necessarily. And one name I recognize is not necessarily because he's an LSU Tiger. It's because his name is Y.A. Tittle.
Yeah,
like that. You just know from great quarterbacks.
Look at those years. So Mawai and Robinson, was essentially like the Veterans Committee selection. He'd been on the ballot and taken off the ballot, and he was the Veterans Selection Committee guy.
Right.
So the last time an LSU Tiger was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame was before I was born. Class of 1976. Tittle was put in 71, and Van Buren was 65. Obviously, Mawai, Reed, and Robinson are all products of Louisiana high schools. Mawai went to Leesville High. Ed Reed went to Destrehan. And Johnny Robinson went to university. Mawai said, when asked... When he told NOLA.com, we've got the whole state covered from North Louisiana with Mr. Johnny to Central Louisiana with me and South Louisiana with Ed. It's just a testament to the type of athletes we have in the state of Louisiana. It's special. Another guy who nearly got in, who I feel is going to get in the next few years, another former LSU standout is offensive lineman Alan Faneca. He made the cut from 15 finalists to 10 finalists, but was eliminated from consideration during the final selection round. Faneca has been a finalist the last 4 years. The other finalists that were considered but failed to make the cut for induction were former Denver Broncos defensive back Steve Atwater, St. Louis Rams wide receiver Isaac Bruce, Indianapolis Colts running back, and man who was part of the greatest ESPN Madden show moment of all time, Edgerrin James, which we've talked about on this show. When you have a trap house in the hood of Miami with Trick Daddy just to play video games, I think you deserve to be in the Hall of Fame just for that reason.
We've been over this before.
We've already been over this.
We have touched on this.
Yes. John Lynch, great safety as well, and Richard Seymour, another New England Patriot, and Don Correll and Tom Flores, coach of the Chargers and coach of the Raiders. Think about this. Do you realize Ed Reed, Cody? Ed Reed was a two-star prospect coming out of Destrehan.
I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise
me. The only scholarship offer he had was from Tulane.
Wow.
And Butch Davis found him, then at the Miami head coach, and he became an instant factor at Miami, All-American, national champion, first-round draft pick. Defensive player of the year. And now he's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
All around badass.
So remember that. I want everyone to take a mental note. And remember that when we talk this week during signing day and people throw out, oh, he's a five star, he's a four star, he's a three star, so forth. Remember that Ed Reed was a two star guy that no one in the state wanted, including LSU. And the only scholarship offer he had was from Tulane until Miami came in at the last minute because Butch Davis knew how to recruit and said, that's a guy that I can develop. So it really doesn't matter what your star rating is. If you can play, you're going to find a way to play in the league and you're going to find a way to be great. Plain and simple. So a terrific Hall of Fame class. I mean, Kevin Mawai played 16 seasons with the Seahawks, Jets, and Titans. We know him more for his time with the Jets. That's when he really became a prolific player. He was only an 8-time Pro Bowler, 3-time All-Pro, and a member of the Hall's All-Decade team for the 2000s. He'd previously been a finalist the last 2 years. Ed Reed was an All-American at Miami, like I said. He was a 9-time Pro Bowler, 5-time All-Pro in 12 years. Won a Super Bowl in the famous game where the lights went out in the Superdome. And Robinson's induction as a senior candidate ends a long wait for the 80-year-old who's still rocking. He gets to enjoy being inducted into Canton. He was on the ballot 43 times, 15 as a modern era finalist, and 28 years as a senior candidate, dating back to 1977. Of course, Johnny was famously part of LSU's 1958 national championship team. He's a first-round draft pick in 1960, played for the Dallas Texans, who later became, obviously, the Kansas City Chiefs. He played 12 seasons for the Texans and the Chiefs from 60 to 71, and he was a starter in their victory in Super Bowl IV over the Minnesota Vikings, held at Tulane Stadium. So happy for Johnny, he said this, "It's a thrill. There were times where I didn't think it would ever happen, but it did. To be able to join guys like Willie Lanier and Bobby Bell and Lynn Dawson, and, of course, Jimmy Taylor, former LSU Green Bay Packers star, who was one of my favorite star players. It's really special." The class of 2019 will officially be enshrined at the induction ceremony held August 3rd in Canton, Ohio. So as an LSU guy, Cody, how do you feel about not having one but two Tigers going in this year? Bleeding purple and gold going to be taking the stage there in Canton, Ohio, brother.
I mean, that's absolutely incredible. I can't tell you the last time I purposefully and excitedly watched the Hall of Fame speeches. Usually I'll catch them on Twitter. Somebody will put their clips on Twitter or something like that of the Hall of Fame speech and this and that. For obvious reasons, I will be tuned in live to these Hall of Fame inductions to see what, you know, guys like Kevin Mawai have to say. Even Ed Reed, who's not an LSU guy, when he was playing in the league and the Ravens defense was just, you know, vaunted and terrifying, you did not want to see the Baltimore Ravens on defense.
Best safety of his generation, by far.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I took a lot of pride in just the fact that he was from Louisiana. So regardless, LSU guys or not, this Louisiana flavor, if you will, going into the Hall of Fame, I will be watching live these interviews. So much more excited now than I've been for probably any Hall of Fame induction of recent years that I would care about.
And as a very humbled voter for the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame and a member of the Louisiana Sports Writers Association, I've been to more than my share fair of induction ceremonies for the Louisiana Sports Hall, which right. Both Mawai and Johnny Robinson and Ed Reed are all part of.
Right.
Okay, I was there for Ed's induction year as well as Kevin's. And they were tremendous speeches. Like, they were tremendous. My wife even mentioned it. She said, "I remember Ed and Kevin. Like, you will remember them. They will bring the speeches. Like, you're not going to be disappointed with what they're going to bring to the table." And I would anticipate Johnny, being his age and feeling like he was never going to get in, there's going to be some emotion there when he takes the stage and gets that gold jacket.
He's going to be like the kid that opens the Nintendo 64 on Christmas morning, right? You got to love that emotion.
Yeah. So congratulations to a pair of former LSU Tigers and another guy from the state of Louisiana that played high school ball here. All three played high school ball here. So great moment for the state of Louisiana getting into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So congratulations to Ed Reed, Johnny Robinson, and the one and only Kevin Mawai. When we come back, it'll be time for some Louisiana wrap-up here on a Monday edition of Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers.
Let's put the spotlight on the boot. It's time for the Louisiana Wrap-Up.
Rap Game is back on 103.7 The Game. We're live, always live, from the 237 Roof Studios here in Upper Lafayette. And you heard the man. We're going to do a little Louisiana Wrap-Up right now, which is funny. Ray, you probably agree. We could have done the Louisiana Wrap-Up Hall of Fame edition if we really, really wanted to. But we're ever branching out here.
I wanted to give the Hall of Famers their own love. They didn't have to share the spotlight.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to say. And not only do they not need to share the spotlight, but what we're going to talk about in the Louisiana wrap-up here needs a little shine for itself. So let's start maybe with the bad, and then we'll move to the good. It's the Louisiana Spotlight in Boone, North Carolina, talking about the one Raging Cajuns men's hoops team. What do you got for us, Ray?
A big what the hell happened with the Raging Cajuns men's basketball team. Like, it started off at Boone, North Carolina on Thursday, right? They lost 104-77 to a team that had 6 wins. That was a 6-win team. This isn't Georgia State. This is 6-win Appy State.
Yeah, this isn't football.
This isn't football. None of the, I don't even think any of those football players are allowed to play basketball. Okay? And the Raging Cajuns go on the road against two teams that they should have defeated. They're more talented than. They're better coached than. And they drop both of them. If the Raging Cajuns would have won both of their games, they would be right now, this morning, second in the Sun Belt standings. In the Sun Belt Conference standings. Now they're in the middle of the pack, right below the middle of the pack. They're hovering around with ULM. What the hell happened in North Carolina? North Cackalack. I don't know what happened to them, but the 27-point beatdown to a 6-win team on Thursday, it only got worse when they continued in Carolina and went to Coastal Carolina on Saturday, and you're thinking, well, this will be a great time for them to rebound and get it together. They still got so much to play for. This is still a talented team. They got Jakinen Gant, who's in the conversation for being considered to be the offensive player of the year or just the player of the year in the Sun Belt Conference. And then they go out and lose by 17 points to Coastal Carolina, the Chanticleers. Love saying that name, by the way. It's a terrific name. Chanticleers.
And the Roosters.
So they went on the road and lost to a 6-win team by 27 points. And then they followed up that road trip in North Cackalack with a 17-point loss to a team that was a mediocre team at best, an 11-win team. Yeah. The Raging Cajuns are trending downward. They should have won both of those games and right now sit pretty second place in the Sun Belt Conference with the two big games they got coming up at home this week. And instead, now they find themselves hovering around with ULM and trying to figure out what the hell has happened to the Raging Cajuns. It is perplexing. I can't tell you what it is. Bob Marlin is one of the best coaches you will ever be around. And they have talented players on that roster. There's no reason, there's no logic that you can provide to me that's going to explain why this team lost by 27 points to App State and then 17 to Coastal Carolina. There is just none. It is inexplicable for them to lose those two games.
The only good news is that none of this really matters if they can come through once the conference tournament gets there. You know, Sunbelt's only putting their conference champion in the big dance, so not all hope lost for the Cajuns.
The way they're playing right now,
they ain't getting there.
They're not getting there.
No. Okay. I agree. But
I know it's only the half, we're right around the halfway point or a little past the halfway point of the Sunbelt conference play. I get that. They still have time to turn around. So look, if they take down Georgia State, you know, they can get their mojo back and right. Do something. So, yes, there's still plenty of time, but they have to play better.
Right? Something's got to change, exactly.
Something's got to change.
We'll continue our trip around the boot in this Louisiana wrap-up by heading to Grambling. We haven't been there in a while, Ray. What's going down in Grambling?
We're going to talk women's basketball at that.
No way.
Watch out now.
Come on, SWAC women's basketball.
Grambling beat Arkansas Pine Bluff 77-57. You're like, well, Ray, why the hell are you talking about Grambling State women's basketball? Well, let me tell you why.
Not so fast.
Because Shakyla Hill, young lady that plays for Grambling State, you should know her name because she etched her name in college women's basketball record books on Saturday afternoon as she led Grambling past Arkansas Pine Bluff in a SWAC game there at Frederick C. Hobde Assembly Center. Why is it worth noting what she did? Well, she posted her second career quadruple double.
She did it two times.
She's done it twice, bruh. She's done it twice. Hill posted her second quadruple double, a feat that has never been captured before in the NCAA Division I era.
That's ballin'.
The senior guard from Little Rock, Arkansas, posted her first quadruple double in a win over Alabama State, just a few weeks back on January 3rd. This girl's had two quadruple-double games in the same month, man. In the same month. Like, I just...
That's impressive.
I'm sorry. Her first one came last year. Last year at around this time, sorry. So in a span of a year, she's had two quadruple-doubles. Now, last year, she joined Sonya Tate of Arkansas State, Veronica Petrie of Loyal Chicago, and Jackie Spencer of Louisville as the only NCAA Division I women's basketball players to register a quadruple-double in history. Now she has two by herself. She's the first accomplishment to do it twice. She finished the game with a game-high 21 points, 16 rebounds, 13 assists, and 10 steals.
God.
She also did it by shooting 7 of 15 from the floor and 6 of 9 from the free throw line in 32 minutes of action.
Have a game, kid. Have a game.
And she got the quadruple-double with a minute to go. With 52 seconds left in the final period, she got her last steal to give her 10. I'll say it again. 21, 16, 13, and 10. That is another
Bingo.
Level.
Yeah, right.
Another level. That is balling out of control. What an accomplishment and what a player there at Grambling State University. You don't know her, you need to follow her on Twitter. You need to check her out. You need to watch some YouTube clips. She can ball out of control. Worth all worthy of all the spotlight that's going to come her way because of the quadruple-double. Her second in her career, the first to do so in women's basketball. When we come back, we're going to talk to our good friend Jarrett Rozier of Tiger Details, breaking down LSU men's basketball and some National Signing Day preview right here on Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. Welcome back to Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsons III, here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios here in Upper Lafayette. You can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Just a reminder, tonight, keep it live and local right here on 103.7 The Game, because we will have the Will Wade Show broadcasting starting at 7 o'clock live here on 103.7 The Game. Right now, we're going to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our next guest. He joins us every Monday because he's the pro's pro. It's the one and only from Tiger Details, Jarrett Rozier. Jarrett, how are you this morning, brother?
Hey, man, I'm doing okay. How y'all making out?
Making out well. I have to ask, my first question to you is, did you take part in any of the second line boycott bowl festivities down in New Orleans yesterday? And if so, when did you get back to your house this morning?
No, actually, I ended up coming back up to Baton Rouge and having kind of a lazy chunk of the Sunday and had the game on kind of in the background a little bit at the apartment. I went down to New Orleans for a little bit, but that like the boycott bowl that we talked about with all those musical acts was packed. And I mean, they sold out their tickets, and I said, I'm going to go ahead and try and be a little bit more productive up in Baton Rouge than I might be if I spend all day here.
Look, being an adult, man, sometimes you have to be an adult, and it's disappointing, ain't it?
I know. And every time I make an adult choice, I feel like I disappoint a lot of people because they used to be being a little bit more silly at times.
Nice. Well, Jarrett, I appreciate you making some time for us, as always, brother. Let's talk a little LSU men's hoops. A disappointing game in a lot of fashions. They lose 90-89 to Arkansas there inside the PMAC. They made a heck of a game of it, obviously. Towards the end, in the last 10 minutes, they rallied. For a game that was the PMAC very much became the Def Dome on Saturday night. It was packed, and LSU did a lot of things right. They out-rebounded Arkansas 44-20. They hit 32 of their 38 free throws compared to Arkansas only doing 7 of 11. Arkansas had two of its top scorers foul out in the final minutes of the game. And yet Arkansas won the game 90-89, and a big part of that was because they went 13 of 24 from three-point range, and LSU had its worst game of the season from 3-point, 5 of 24. Give me your thoughts from Saturday's disappointing loss to the Razorbacks.
Yeah, it seemed like kind of a combination of a couple of the issues that had hurt LSU earlier in its schedule, and then some of the recent concerns that Will Wade had had about this young team just not handling its success very well and taking some things a little bit too lightly, a little bit for granted, because they didn't seem to really live up to the energy of that Pac PMAC for a lot of the game, and it kind of manifested in allowing Arkansas some open shots from the perimeter, which was something that at the very onset of the season was an issue for the Tigers defensively. They gave up some open shots on the perimeter, and obviously we've talked at times about the transition defense. And then they turned the ball over, which has been a concern for LSU for big stretches of this season, and that turned into some of those transition baskets and some easy scoring opportunities for Arkansas. And so you end up getting down 18, the biggest deficit that they've faced at home all season, the biggest deficit that they've faced in SEC play. The only team that opened up a wider margin was Oklahoma State a couple months back. And as much as we spent all week saying that's great that they came back against Missouri, but these young guys can't take that for granted and put themselves in a big hole again, they did exactly that and then fight all the way back to a one-point lead and then make kind of a, whether you want to say ill-advised or ballsy choice with the Tremont Waters half-court alley-oop pass attempt that turned into another turnover. And when something like that happens, you kind of just think that the likelihood is that Arkansas is going to take advantage because of the opportunity that you just gave them, kind of basketball karma, and it went exactly that way.
Yeah, and the other thing is the not getting up. You know, they've done a nice job of getting behind in some games, right, and kind of coming out a little sluggish to start these contests, especially during conference play, but they've been able to rally and have great runs to end the game and pull out these wins, and they just weren't able to do it. And what surprised me, Jarrett, more than anything, is they knew that this Arkansas team was going to be game, right? Like, they just had to have overtime to beat them only a few weeks back on the road. So you knew that you were going to get a great effort from Arkansas, and to have the PMAC packed out like it was, and you're facing a team that gave you everything that you could handle and you needed overtime to win just a few weeks ago, to come out kind of flat and sluggish in a lot of different areas, I was surprised that the Tigers had that early on. I mean, I know they had the great run to end the game, to make it a game, but I was surprised by that, especially with having just played Arkansas a few weeks beforehand.
Yeah, and that makes sense because they did have to go to overtime in Arkansas, but I don't know that I was surprised so much as disappointed, I guess, because they know that even with Arkansas making that comeback at home, that they are or should be a better basketball team this season than Arkansas. And I think they feel like they had learned a lot and grown up a lot since that game, and that coming home to a much friendlier environment, because Arkansas can be a tough place to play, and just the improvements that they felt like they had made over the last couple of weeks. You know, I could see that LSU had started to appear to most people, and I mean a lot of people in that locker room, that they were at a different level than Arkansas this year, and I think that's fair, but I think you can't take that for granted, as we saw Saturday. And with this Arkansas game, as close as that was on the road a couple weeks ago, when you looked at the February schedule and you see the Mississippi State game this week, where Mississippi State's kind of come on and climbed into the rankings, or the Auburn game, where Auburn was a team that's predicted to be one of the top teams in the SEC, and then obviously the Kentucky trip and then Tennessee coming later in the month. Arkansas wasn't one that, for an excitement, necessarily moved the needle as much as it maybe should have. And we saw the Tigers, unfortunately, play that way for a huge chunk of that game.
Yeah, and here's the thing for LSU, Jarrett, like you just said. They're not going to have much time at all to kind of, you know, feel sorry for themselves, because it's Wednesday at Mississippi State in Starkville. Mississippi State's right now the number 22 team in the country. Then they have to come back home and face an Auburn team that is disappointing. They are struggling right now, but they were their defending co-regular season champions of the SEC and a team that was ranked for the better part of the season in the top 25. So you know that they have some players that can make them dangerous. And then it's right back on the road the next Tuesday at Kentucky, who's a top 10 team, and we know what they bring to the table. So what do you think the message is going to be from Will Wade to his team now this week? I mean, they dropped a game that they shouldn't have dropped, and they're about to play this kind of murderer's row schedule. Tennessee is on the horizon on the 23rd inside the PMAC. What do you think Will Wade's message to his team is this week as they prepare for this big stretch after coming off the humbling defeat?
I'm sure it's going to be pretty stern. he's going to tell those guys to really just kind of knock it off, stop taking things for granted, and realize, you know, as much success as we've had this year, this is what I've been trying to tell you to avoid, and hopefully you can take this disappointment as a lesson and realize that, you know, winning at Missouri is not what this team's goal is. Winning at Arkansas or beating Alabama at home, none of these games or anything to get overly excited about, because they have bigger things in mind, and to reach those points they have to get back to focusing on day to day and improving some of the issues that they've been trying to improve much of this year, and just stop thinking that they're better than anyone and work to prove it rather than kind of taking anything for granted.
Oh, we're on with Jarrett Rozier of Tiger Details. Do you think with the loss, do you think that's going to drop them out of the top 25, or do you think they just drop down in the top 25 and hover around maybe 24 or 25 when the polls is released later today, Jarrett?
Yeah, I was kind of expecting them to still be clinging to a ranking somewhere. I'm interested to see exactly where it ends up, but ultimately they're going to probably be in like a week-to-week situation anyway, regardless of where they might land for the next couple of days.
So, but you think that they're going to still be roughly, they're still going to be around?
Yeah, I do. I'm trying to see if maybe those have come out, or if they haven't, they'll be coming out here shortly. But my expectation coming into this morning was that they would still be clinging to a ranking for this week.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, that you mentioned that this is a young team, and I would agree with that. And we're only halfway through SEC play, so there's still some time to make adjustments. And then really what you want from your team is playing at the right time, right at towards the tail end of the season, after the halfway point, heading into the conference tournament and hopefully getting some mojo working during the conference tournament that you can carry over into the big dance. So they still have plenty of time to do that. What's one of the things that you feel like this team has to improve on, though, Jarrett, if they're going to do that, if they're going to go on the road Wednesday and beat Mississippi State, come back at home, beat Auburn, beat Kentucky, beat our Tennessee team, or at least compete with a Tennessee team? What are maybe one or two things that they really need to do to improve on in between now and then to reach their potential as a team this year?
I mean, I think a lot of it really is sort of some of those intangible type things that we're talking about, to be up and playing to their potential every single time out, because you've seen them have different issues at different times. The turnovers have been an issue at times. The defensive energy and just closing out on guys, whether stopping some of those interior scoring opportunities against Georgia or on the perimeter against Arkansas, that's been an issue at different times. Rebounding for stretches this season was an issue, but has been much improved of late. But it seems like there's one or two things. It's almost like a game of whack-a-mole a little bit, that when they're not ready to play up on a given day, they may look great in one area, but then another area is popping up and costing them. And so they really just need to continue to get to a point where they're clicking on all cylinders the way they were for a few games there early in SEC play before this past week and a half, because they've shown flashes as good as almost anyone in the country. But then they have these kind of letdown games too.
Jarrett, let's switch over to football. National Signing Day, the traditional National Signing Day, is going to be Wednesday. We know 19 of LSU's already locked up 19 guys during the early signing period and last December, but there's still plenty of targets to go after. And still plenty of guys that they're wanting to bring in here to polish off the class, so to speak. So who are we looking at? Who are they looking at? I know it's been kind of indicated that the what we believe to be a package deal with the Shoffer boys is, in fact, not because the older brothers decided to go back to junior college for another year. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. So Rodney will be now a 2020 JUCO prospect, and it's all about Ishmael right now.
Okay, so that's so it doesn't, you know, that's not a package deal. So let's start there. Obviously, Ish is the biggest fish of the guys that they still have targets for right now. Is it going to just come down to Alabama, LSU, and where do you think that's heading into right now? Did Orgeron and his staff have a last visit, a good visit with him over the weekend? How did that boil down?
Yeah, most of the guys that are still in play for those last six spots, including the A-meet duo of Ishmael Sopcich and Devontae Lee, were on campus this weekend. And, I mean, a lot of eyes are just going to be on those guys heading into Wednesday afternoon's ceremony, announcement and signing ceremony at A-meet High School. And I think as much as Texas A&M has been in play for both of those guys, or Kentucky at points for Devontae, I think for Ish, it really does boil down to, barring some last-minute surprise, it does boil down to Alabama or LSU. And I think whether Ishmael or Byron Young, the Alabama commitment on the defensive line that LSU has remained very much in play with, that's kind of where a lot of my focus is. I think they feel good about Devontae Lee. I think they still feel good about Mo Hampton, the athlete from Memphis, the two-sport athlete from Memphis that has been committed to this program for a long time. And to me, I just think they're trying to finish strong up front on the defensive side. They got the commitment from JUCO defensive end Sony Fanua on Sunday, and I think that was a big start to this week. And now they're trying to see if they can keep Ish home, and whether or not they can keep Ish home, if they can maybe swing Byron Young to come join this class as well. I think that's the priority. And then beyond that, there are a few other guys still in the mix. Ray Parker, the tight end, and in some people's minds, long-term tackle prospect from Ruston, a long-time commitment. He's looking less likely to be in this class. We're still waiting to see what happens there. And
why, Jared, if you don't mind telling the listeners, why is that? Because he looked like he was a locked-up guy for LSU. Is it because of a position thing where he wants to be an lineman or a tight end or whatever it may be? What's going on with that? Why is he kind of veered away off LSU?
Yeah, I think with Ray, it's a pretty complicated situation. There had been some grade concerns with him at one point where he still had some ground to make up, and I'm not positive where he stands with that. I know he was working hard and things were going well, and so a lot of people are kind of reacting to the grade aspect, but I'm not sure how exactly the latest is with that and if he ultimately qualifies or not. I don't think it's as much of a concern maybe as it was at one point months ago. The position aspect has been something that's been at play throughout his recruitment because he is very firm that he wants to be a tight end, and most bigger programs have looked at him as more of a tackle. I think the programs are aware that he wants to play tight end, though, and so most of the conversations that they've had with him have been about tight end, but I think there's been kind of an uneasiness from him because he knows that there has been a lot of talk about him potentially transitioning to tackle at some point in his career. And so that's been something at play. And then he was aware that if he didn't sign, as all these prospects are, if he didn't sign with LSU in December, that things could be reevaluated and the spot might not still be there for him because that makes the coaching staff a little bit uneasy.
Right.
And so there was some reevaluation after that December 19th date came and went with him not signing and that being kind of a surprise to folks in Baton Rouge. And so Tennessee's come into play, and on the LSU side, Garmin Randolph, the tight end from Georgia, has come into play as a potential guy to fill up one of the last couple spots of this class rather than Ray, depending on how some things shake out these next few days.
So you mentioned the tight end Garmon Randolph out of Georgia. Where does LSU stand with Christian Williams? I know he's the 4-star out of Daphne, Alabama cornerback. Is he still in the mix, or do you think LSU can pick him up? Corey Raymond and the guys.
Yeah, I think Christian Williams is actually one of the players right now that LSU fans should probably feel most confident about, despite the fact that he's committed to home state Alabama. Just the way Alabama's class has gone and some of the numbers that they've filled up on the whole, as well as in that secondary, that there's an opportunity to flip Christian Williams this week. And he's a guy that a lot of the LSU signees in December told me, even before that point, that they felt pretty good about the likelihood that he ended up in purple and gold for college. And so LSU has continued to maintain that relationship and sell him on the idea of coming to be a part of this DBU program, particularly with, after all the flirtations from around the country, Corey Raymond looking like he's going to be, still at his alma mater here moving forward. And so I think you feel good about Mo Hampton. I think they feel pretty good about Devontae. I think they feel good about Christian Williams, and they added the commitment of Sony Finua on Sunday. And so then you just look at those last couple spots, and can they get the two defensive linemen? If not, does Garmon slide into that last spot? You certainly hope that you get at least Ish or Byron. If you get both, then I think the class has to be looked at as a home run. But Christian's a guy they feel pretty good about, and it's just down to really, for them, the defensive linemen and then potentially Garmon Randolph, or if they can still get Jay Ward, potentially, if a spot is still available there at that 25th spot in the class.
Where do they stand? I know a 4-star prospect, a coveted guy, Charles Moore, defensive end / D tackle out of Mississippi. He was a longtime commitment for Mississippi State. He decommitted earlier this month, Jarrett. And I know Auburn is in the mix, Mississippi State's in the mix, and so is LSU. How does LSU, and from your sources, how do they feel about getting Charles Moore to commit to them?
He's kind of on the lower end of, optimism or reasons for optimism to end up a part of this class. He would certainly be a great option if they could get him, if something falls through with Sopcher or Young, but it seems like he's more likely to end up at a Florida or Auburn.
Florida, Auburn. Okay. Jarrett, I appreciate you making some time for us as always, brother. And I know you've been, it's going to be a hell of a busy week for you as always. And I know you're disappointed about yesterday's halftime show because no Andre 3000, there was no Outkast reunion, man. I was hoping, right? You're disappointed like me. I was hoping there'd be an Outkast reunion, and there was not.
Yeah, I was glad that we at least got Big Boy. I've realized how disappointed I've been in a lot of halftime shows of late, and I felt like, all right, Big Boy, come save this thing. And I thought he was good for the 20 seconds or whatever they gave him, and then he was off. I'm glad that I did have a chance to see Outkast at some point. That would have salvaged Sunday for me if they would have brought Big Boy and Andre out for a little bit more time together. I mean, in Atlanta, it would have been perfect.
Brother, I appreciate you as always, man. Have a great week. We'll talk to you soon.
You too, Ray. Thanks, man.
Jared Rozier, Tiger Details. We'll wrap up the wrap game with RP3 after this here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. Welcome back to Wrap Game with RP3 here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. That's going to do it for us. Up next, Jim Rome Show, 11 to 2. Have a great day.